The anti-speciesist revolution, speciesism. When is it ethically acceptable to harm another sentient being? On some fairly modest assumptions, to harm or kill someone simply on the grounds they belong to a different gender, sexual orientation or ethnic group is unjustified. Such distinctions are real but ethically irrelevant. On the other hand, species membership is normally reckoned an ethically relevant criterion. Fundamental to our conceptual scheme is the pre-Darwinian distinction between humans and animals. In law, non-human animals share with inanimate objects the status of property. As property, non-human animals can be bought, sold, killed or otherwise harmed as humans see fit. In consequence, humans treat non-human animals in ways that would earn a lifetime prison sentence without parole if our victims were human. From an evolutionary perspective, this contrast in status isn't surprising. In our ancestral environment of adaptation, the capacity to hunt, kill and exploit sentient beings of other species was fitness enhancing. Our moral intuitions have been shaped accordingly. Yet can we ethically justify such behavior today? Naively, one reason for disregarding the interests of non-humans is the dimmer switch model of consciousness. Humans matter more than non-human animals because, most, humans are more intelligent. Intuitively, more intelligent beings are more conscious than less intelligent beings. Consciousness is the touchstone of moral status. A problem with the dimmer switch model is that it's empirically unsupported among vertebrates with central nervous systems, and probably in cephalopods such as the octopus as well. Microelectrode studies of the brains of awake human subjects suggest that the most intense forms of experience, for example agony, terror and orgasmic bliss, are mediated by the limbic system, not the prefrontal cortex. Our core emotions are evolutionarily ancient and strongly conserved. Humans share the anatomical and molecular substrates of our core emotions with the non-human animals whom we factory farm and kill. By contrast, distinctively human cognitive capacities such as generative syntax, or the ability to do higher mathematics, are either phenomenologically subtle or impenetrable to introspection. To be sure, genetic and epigenetic differences exist between, say, a pig and a human being that explain our adult behavioral differences, for example the allele of the FOXP2 gene implicated in the human capacity for recursive syntax. Such mutations have little to do with raw sentience. Anti-speciesism. So what is the alternative to traditional anthropocentric ethics? Anti-speciesism is not the claim that all animals are equal, or that all species are of equal value, or that a human or a pig is equivalent to a mosquito. Rather, the anti-speciesist claims that, other things being equal, equally strong interests should count equally. Experiences that are subjectively negative or positive in hedonic tone to the same degree must count for the same. And conscious beings of equivalent sentience often have equally strong interests, which, other things being equal, we must care for and respect equally, though other animals who may be less sentient can also have important interests as well. A pig, for example, is of comparable sentience to a prelinguistic human toddler. As it happens, a pig is of comparable, or superior, intelligence to a toddler as well. However, such cognitive prowess is ethically incidental. If ethical status is a function of sentience, then to factory farm and slaughter a pig is as ethically abhorrent as to factory farm and slaughter a human baby. To exploit one and nurture the other expresses an irrational but genetically adaptive prejudice. On the face of it, this anti-speciesist claim isn't just wrong-headed, it's absurd. Philosopher Jonathan Haidt speaks of moral dumbfounding, where we just know something is wrong but can't articulate precisely why. Haidt offers the example of consensual incest between an adult brother and sister who use birth control. For evolutionary reasons, we just know such an incestuous relationship is immoral. In the case of any comparisons of pigs with human infants and toddlers, we just know at some deep level that any alleged equivalence in status is unfounded. After all, if there were no ethically relevant distinction between a pig and a toddler, or between a battery farm chicken and a human infant, then the daily behavior of ordinary meat-eating humans would be sociopathic, which sounds crazy. In fact, unless the psychiatrist's Bible, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, is modified explicitly to exclude behavior towards non-humans, most of us do risk satisfying its diagnostic criteria for the disorder. Even so, humans often conceive of ourselves as animal lovers. Despite the horrors of factory farming, and in general of slaughterhouses where all farmed animals perish, most consumers of meat and animal products are clearly not sociopaths in the normal usage of the term. Most factory farm managers are not wantonly cruel, and the majority of slaughterhouse workers are not sadists who delight in suffering. Serial killers of non-human animals are just ordinary men doing a distasteful job, obeying orders, on pain of losing their livelihoods. Should we expect anything different? Political theorist Hannah Arendt spoke famously of the banality of evil. If 21st century humans are collectively doing something post-human superintelligence will reckon monstrous, a crime against sentience akin to the human Holocaust or Atlantic slave trade, then it's easy to assume our moral intuitions would disclose this to us. Our intuitions don't disclose anything of the kind, so we sleep easy. But both natural selection and the historical record offer powerful reasons for doubting the trustworthiness of our naive moral intuitions. So the possibility that human civilization might be founded upon some monstrous evil should be taken seriously, even if the possibility seems transparently absurd at the time. One possible speciesist response is to raise the question of potential. Even if a pig is as sentient as a human toddler, there is a fundamental distinction between human toddlers and pigs. Only a toddler has the potential to mature into a rational adult human being. The problem with this response is that it contradicts our treatment of humans who lack potential. Thus, we recognize that a toddler with a progressive disorder who will never live to celebrate his third birthday deserves at least as much love, care and respect as his normally developing peers, not to be packed off to a factory farm on the grounds it's a shame to let good protein go to waste. We recognize a similar duty of care for mentally handicapped adult humans and cognitively frail old people. For sure, historical exceptions exist to this perceived duty of care for vulnerable humans, for example the Nazi euthanasia program, with its eugenicist conception of life unworthy of life. But by common consent, we value young children and cognitively challenged adults for who they are, not simply for who they may, or may not, one day become. On occasion, there may controversially be instrumental reasons for allocating more care and resources to a potential genius or exceptionally gifted child than to a normal human. Yet disproportionate intraspecies resource allocation may be justified, not because high IQ humans are more sentient, but because of the anticipated benefits to society as a whole. Practical implications. 1. In vitro tarianism. The greatest source of severe, chronic and readily avoidable suffering in the world today is man-made animal agriculture, most notably factory farming. Humans currently slaughter over 50 billion sentient beings each year. One implication of an anti-speciesist ethic is that factory farms should be shut and their surviving victims rehabilitated. In common with most ethical revolutions in history, the prospect of humanity switching to a cruelty-free diet first strikes most practically minded folk as utopian dreaming. Realists certainly have plenty of hard evidence to bolster their case. As English essayist William Hazlitt observed, the least pain in our little finger gives us more concern and uneasiness than the destruction of millions of our fellow beings. Without the aid of 21st century technology, the mass slaughter and abuse of our fellow animals might continue indefinitely. Yet tissue science technology promises to allow consumers to become moral agents without the slightest hint of personal inconvenience. Lab-grown in vitro meat produced in cell culture rather than a live animal has long been a staple of science fiction. But global veganism, or its ethical in vitrotarian equivalent, is no longer a futuristic fantasy. Rapid advances in tissue engineering mean that in vitro meat will shortly be developed and commercialized. Today's experimental cultured mincemeat can be supplanted by mass-manufactured gourmet steaks for the consumer market. Perhaps critically for its rapid public acceptance, in vitro meat does not need to be genetically modified, thereby spiking the guns of techno-Luddites who might otherwise worry about Frankenburgers. Indeed, cultured meat products will be more natural in some ways than their antibiotic-laced counterparts derived from farmed animals. Momentum for commercialization is growing. Non-profit research organizations like New Harvest, working to develop alternatives to conventionally produced meat, have been joined by hard-headed businessmen. Visionary entrepreneur and Stanford academic Peter Thiel has just funneled $350,000 into Modern Meadow, a startup that aims to combine 3D printing with in vitro meat cultivation. Within the next decade or so, gourmet steaks could be printed out from biological materials. In principle, the technology should be scalable. While work on in vitro meat continues, rapid advances are being made in the development of so-called plant meats. Beyond Meat, for example, has already brought to market the first plant-based meat with a texture almost identical to chicken flesh. Tragically, billions of non-human animals will atrociously suffer and die this century at human hands before the dietary transition is complete. Humans are not obligate carnivores, Eating meat and animal products is a lifestyle choice, but I like the taste. Is not a morally compelling argument. Vegans and animal advocates ask whether we are ethically entitled to wait on a technological fix. The anti-speciesist answer is clear. Number 2. Compassionate biology. If and when humans stop systematically harming other sentient beings, will our ethical duties to members of other species have been discharged? Not if the same ethical considerations as apply to members of other human races or age groups apply also to members of other species of equivalent sentience. Thus, if famine breaks out in sub-Saharan Africa and young human children are starving, then we recognize we have a duty to send aid, or better still, to take proactive measures to ensure famines do not arise in the first instance, i.e. to provide not just food aid but family planning. So why not assist, say, starving free living elephants? Until recently, no comparable interventions were feasible for members of other species. The technical challenges were insurmountable. Not least, the absence of cross-species fertility control technologies would have often made bad problems worse. Helping free-living non-humans would just lead to an unsustainable population explosion followed by ecological collapse. Yet thanks to the exponential growth of computer power, every cubic meter of the planet will shortly be computationally accessible to micromanagement, surveillance and control. Harnessed to biotechnology, nanotechnology and robotics, such tools confer unprecedented power over nature. With unbridled power comes complicity. Ethically speaking, how many of the traditional cruelties of the living world do we wish to perpetuate? Orthodox conservation biologists argue we should not interfere, humans can't police nature. Anti-speciesists disagree. Advocates of compassionate biology argue that humans and non-humans alike should not be parasitized, starved, disemboweled, asphyxiated, or eaten alive. As always, bioconservatives insist such miseries are natural, status quo bias runs deep. Custom will reconcile people to any atrocity, observed George Bernard Shaw. Snuff movies in the guise of nature documentaries are quite popular on YouTube, a counterpoint to the Disney-fied wildlife shows aired on mainstream TV. Moreover, even sympathetic critics of compassionate biology might respond that helping free-living members of other species is prohibitively expensive. Inadequate welfare safety net scarcely exists for humans in many parts of the world. So how can we contemplate its extension to non-humans, even just to large-brained, long-lived vertebrates in our nature reserves? Provision of comprehensive health care for all free-living elephants, for example, might cost between $2 or $3 billion annually. Compassionate stewardship of the living world would be technically daunting too, entailing ecosystem management, cross-species fertility control via immunocontraception, veterinary care, emergency famine relief, GPS tracking and monitoring, and ultimately phasing out our genetically reprogramming carnivorous predators. The notional bill could approach the world's $1.7 trillion annual arms budget. But irrespective of cost or time scale, if we are to be consistently non-speciesist, then decisions about resource allocation should be based not on species membership, but directly or indirectly on sentience. An elephant, for example, is at least as sentient as a human toddler, and may well be as sentient if not sapient as adult humans. If it is ethically obligatory to help sick or starving children, then it's ethically obligatory to help sick or starving elephants, not just via crisis interventions but via long-term healthcare support. A traditional conservation biologist might respond that elephants helped by humans are no longer truly wild. Yet on such a criterion, clothes-wearing humans or beneficiaries of food aid and family planning aren't wild humans either. Why should this matter? Free living and wild are conceptually distinct. To assume that the civilizing process should be confined to our own species is mere speciesist prejudice. Humans, transhumans and posthumans must choose what forms of sentience we want to preserve and create on Earth and beyond. Humans already massively intervene in nature, whether through habitat destruction, captive breeding programs for big cats, rewilding, etc. So the question is not whether humans should interfere, but rather what ethical principles should govern our interventions, speciesism and superintelligence. Why should transhumanists care about the suffering of non-human animals? This is not a feel-good issue. One reason we should care cuts to the heart of the future of life in the universe. Transhumanists differ over whether our post-human successors will most likely be non-biological artificial superintelligence, or cyborgs who effectively merge with our hyper-intelligent machines, or our own recursively self-improving biological descendants who modify their own genetic source code and bootstrap their way to full-spectrum superintelligence. Regardless of the dominant life form of the post-human era, biological humans have a vested interest in the behavior of intellectually advanced beings towards cognitively humble creatures, if we survive at all. Compared to post-human superintelligence, archaic humans may be no smarter than pigs or chickens, or perhaps worms. This does not augur well for Homo sapiens. Western-educated humans tend to view giants as faintly ridiculous for practicing ahimsa, or harmlessness, sweeping the ground in front of them to avoid inadvertently treading on insects. How quixotic! Yet the fate of sentient but cognitively humble life forms in relation to vastly superior intelligence is precisely the issue at stake as we confront the prospect of post-human superintelligence. How can we ensure a giant-like concern for comparatively simple-minded creatures such as ourselves? Why should superintelligences care any more than humans about the well-being of their intellectual inferiors? Might distinctively human-friendly superintelligence turn out to be as intellectually incoherent as, say, Aryan-friendly superintelligence? If human primitives are to prove worthy of conservation, how can we implement technologies of impartial friendliness towards other sentients? And if postulants do care, how do we know that a truly benevolent superintelligence wouldn't turn Darwinian life into utilitarianism with a communal hug? Viewed in such a light, biological humanity's prospects in a future world of superintelligence might seem dire. However, this worry expresses a one-dimensional conception of general intelligence. No doubt the nature of mature superintelligence is humanly unknowable. But presumably full-spectrum superintelligence entails, at the very least, a capacity to investigate, understand and manipulate both the formal and the subjective properties of mind. Modern science aspires to an idealized view from nowhere, an impartial, godlike understanding of the natural universe, stripped of any bias in perspective and expressed in the language of mathematical physics. By the same token, a godlike superintelligence must also be endowed with the capacity impartially to grasp all our possible first-person perspectives, not a partial and primitive Machiavellian cunning of the kind adaptive on the African savanna, but an unimaginably radical expansion of our own fitfully growing circle of empathy. What such superhuman perspective-taking ability might entail is unclear. We are familiar with people who display abnormally advanced forms of mind-blind, autistic intelligence in higher mathematics and theoretical physics. Less well-known are hyper-empathizers who display unusually sophisticated social intelligence. Perhaps the most advanced naturally occurring hyper-empathizers exhibit mirror-touch synesthesia. A mirror-touch synesthete cannot be unfriendly towards you because she feels your pain and pleasure as if it were her own. In principle, such unusual perspective-taking capacity could be generalized and extended with reciprocal neuroscanning technology and telemetry into a kind of naturalized telepathy, both between and within species. Interpersonal and cross-species mind-reading could in theory break down hitherto invincible barriers of ignorance between different skull-bound subjects of experience, thereby eroding the anthropocentric, ethnocentric and egocentric bias that has plagued life on Earth to date. Today, the intelligence testing community tends to treat facility at empathetic understanding as if it were a mere personality variable, or at best some sort of second-rate cognition for people who can't do IQ tests. But mind reading can be a highly sophisticated, cognitively demanding ability. Compare, say, the six-order intentionality manifested by Shakespeare. In Othello, for example, Shakespeare intends his audience believe that Iago intends that Othello imagines that Desdemona is in love with Cassio and that Cassio reciprocates Desdemona's amorous feelings. Thus we shouldn't conceive superintelligence as akin to God imagined by someone with autistic spectrum disorder. Rather, full-spectrum superintelligence entails a God's eye capacity to understand the rich multifaceted first-person perspectives of diverse life forms whose mind spaces humans would find incomprehensibly alien. An obvious objection arises. Just because ultra-intelligent posthumans may be capable of displaying empathetic superintelligence, how do we know such intelligence will be exercised? The short answer is that we don't, by analogy. Today's mirror-touch synesthetes might one day neurosurgically opt to become mind-blind. But then equally we don't know whether posthumans will renounce their advanced logico-mathematical prowess in favor of the functional equivalent of wireheading. If they do so, then they won't be superintelligent. The existence of diverse first-person perspectives is a fundamental feature of the natural world, as fundamental as the second law of thermodynamics or the Higgs boson. To be ignorant of fundamental features of the world is to be an idiot savant, a super Watson perhaps, but not a super intelligence. High-tech Jainism? Jules Renard once remarked, "I don't know if God exists, but it would be better for his reputation if he didn't." God's conspicuous absence from the natural world needn't deter us from asking what an omniscient, omnipotent, all-merciful deity would want humans to do with our imminent godlike powers. For we're on the brink of a momentous evolutionary transition in the history of life on Earth. Physicist Freeman Dyson predicts we'll soon be writing genomes as fluently as Blake and Byron wrote verses. The ethical risks and opportunities for apprentice deities are huge. On the one hand, Karl Popper warns, those who promise us paradise on Earth never produced anything but a hell. 20th century history bears out such pessimism. Yet for billions of sentient beings from less powerful species, existing life on Earth is hell. They end their miserable lives on our dinner plates, for the animals it is an eternal thread linker, writes Jewish Nobel laureate Isaac Bashevis-Singer. In a more utopian vein, some utterly sublime scenarios are technically feasible later this century and beyond. It's not clear whether experience below Sidgwick's hedonic zero has any long-term future. Thanks to molecular neuroscience, mastery of the brain's reward circuitry could make everyday life wonderful beyond the bounds of normal human experience. There is no technical reason why the pitiless Darwinian struggle of the past half billion years can't be replaced by an earthly paradise for all creatures great and small. Genetic engineering could allow the lion to lie down with the lamb. Enhancement technologies could transform killer apes into saintly smart angels. Biotechnology could abolish suffering throughout the living world. Artificial intelligence could secure the well-being of all sentients in our forward light cone. Our quasi-immortal descendants may be animated by gradients of intelligent bliss orders of magnitude richer than anything physiologically feasible today. Such fantastical-sounding scenarios may never come to pass. Yet if so, this won't be because the technical challenges prove too daunting, but because intelligent agents choose to forego the molecular keys to paradise for something else. Critically, the substrates of bliss don't need to be species-specific or rationed. Transhumanists believe the well-being of all sentients is the bedrock of any civilization worthy of the name.